What most of us feel is, my kids want more time and my work wants more time and I need more time. We're constantly being pulled and stretched in different directions. Fundamentally, if we don't face the fact that everything we do is about a desire to escape discomfort, we will always become distracted. If you don't control your attention, absolutely someone else will.
Today, digital distractions at an all-time high and the attention economy shaping the way we work, we live, and we connect, there's no better time to have this conversation. So I'm thrilled and super excited to interview today, Nir Eyal.
And so it turns out my accountability buddy, who got me through my second book, Nir Eyal, is here.
We are here in Sydney to interview best-selling author Nir Eyal.
I thought it was a good idea to just let me just do this one thing on my phone real quick. And by the time I looked up from my device, she was gone.
As of 2024, kids in America are being diagnosed with ADHD 10 times higher than kids in Europe. Why is it so bad here in America?
Hundreds of thousands of people who have ADHD who use this book find ways to solve these same problems without pills. Because remember, we don't have a blood test for ADHD. We don't have an x-ray for ADHD. It's a self-reported diagnosis. Am I going to try and escape that discomfort? Am I going to drink it away? Am I going to click it away? Am I going to scroll it away? What am I going to do when I feel that discomfort? And so distracted people keep getting distracted by the same thing again and again and again. Most people, if you ask them, will say it's about carrots and sticks, right? It's about pain and pleasure. And this is what Jeremy Bentham said. This is what Sigmund Freud said. Turns out that's not exactly right. Rather, the only reason we do anything and everything is because of one reason and one reason only. And that one reason is...
You describe distraction as the action you take to escape discomfort. What was your personal wake-up call to that realization?
I was with my daughter one afternoon, and we had some daddy-daughter time planned, just some time to hang out and be together. And I remember we had a book of different activities that we could do. This book had all kinds of games and fun things, you know, do a Sudoku puzzle together, have a paper airplane throwing contest, all kinds of fun things. And one of the activities was to ask each other this question. The question was, if you could have any superpower, what superpower would you want? And I remember that question verbatim, but I can't tell you what my daughter said, because in that moment, I thought it was a good idea to just let me just do this one thing on my phone real quick. And by the time I looked up from my device, she was gone. Because I was sending a very clear message that whatever was on my phone was more important than she was, and she went to go play with some toy outside. So if you ask me today what superpower I would most want, it's the power to be indistractable. I think becoming indistractable is the skill of the century, because there is no facet of your life, your mental health, your physical health, your career, everything depends on your ability to harness your attention, because it is truly how we choose our life.
Can you explain the psychology behind a product that people typically can't stop using? Like, where does this begin and why do people keep going back?
Well, so distraction is not just about products. There's distractions from all kinds of things. Maybe it's good for us to define what we mean by distraction before we begin a conversation on it. So essentially, distraction is any action that pulls you away from what you plan to do. So it's not that the product itself is the problem. You know, people like to blame their phones or social media or the news or whatever. That's the medium you use to distract yourself per se, but that's not really the problem. The problem is not what we call the external triggers, the pings, the dings, the rings. Those only account, studies have found, for about 10% of our distractions. 10% of the time that we check our phone, studies find, is because of an external trigger. So what's the other 90%? The other 90% of the time that we get distracted, it's because of what's called an internal trigger. What is an internal trigger? An internal trigger is an uncomfortable emotional state that we seek to escape. Boredom, loneliness, fatigue, uncertainty, anxiety. So to answer your question, how do we get distracted? How does a product distract us? We are 90% of the time distracting ourselves because when we are bored, we look at the news. You know, we're worried about somebody's problem 5,000 miles away as opposed to thinking about our own problems, right? When we're lonely, we check a dating app or we check social media. When we're uncertain, we want Google to explain things to us. So it's not that necessarily the product itself is the problem. It's that we don't know how to deal with discomfort. But of course, every product you use, everything you are using because you are looking to modulate your mood, because you have to feel something different. So when we start this journey to become indistractable, the first step has to be mastering those internal triggers, or they will become our masters.
You've often been quoted to say time management is pain management. Can you walk us through that connection?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So not only why do we get distracted, by the way, this is not a new problem. It's a very old problem. It's not that, you know, social media created this problem or our phones created this problem. In fact, Plato, the Greek philosopher, was talking about akrasia in the Greek, the tendency to do things against our better interests. He was talking about this 2,500 years ago. So it can't be something that just all of a sudden came because of technology. This is part of the human condition, this tendency that we have to act against our better interests, which is really funny, right? Like, why would we do that? Well, I think to answer that question of why do we keep punching ourselves in the face, getting distracted, procrastinating, saying we're going to do one thing, but we're doing something else, we're actively hurting ourselves. Why do we keep doing that? Well, to answer that question, we have to dig deeper and ask ourselves, well, why do we do anything and everything? What's kind of the seat of human motivation? Now, we used to believe, most people, if you ask them, that will say it's about carrots and sticks, right? It's about pain and pleasure. And this is what Jeremy Bentham said. This is what Sigmund Freud said. Turns out that's not exactly right. That if you look inside the brain as it's making decisions, it turns out the brain is not acting out of pain and pleasure, but rather the only reason we do anything and everything is because of one reason and one reason only. And that one reason is the desire to escape discomfort. Everything you do, every product you use, everything you do is all about the desire to escape discomfort. Even, this is going to rub people the wrong way, like, wait, everything is about escaping pain? How can that be? What about when I want to feel good? Well, even wanting, craving, desire, hungering, lusting for something is itself psychologically destabilizing, right? Think about it. You wanting to feel good is itself uncomfortable. The wanting, the craving, the hunger, being hungry for something, even if you're like, oh, it's going to be delicious, hunger feels bad. So the way the brain gets us to act is by spurring us to action through pain. So what that must therefore mean, if all human behavior is about a desire to escape discomfort, that must therefore mean that time management is nothing more than pain management. Money management is nothing more than pain management. Weight management is nothing more than pain management. It's all about managing discomfort. That's it. And so on one hand, you're like, oh, that's so depressing. Everything we do is about escaping pain. On the other hand, I think it's incredibly liberating because that's the single point of failure. And that's it. So that's really what I try and teach people is first and foremost, how do we master those internal triggers that causes the discomfort? Because look, distraction is not a character flaw. There's nothing wrong with you. The vast majority of people, you think you have ADHD and you haven't been undiagnosed. I have ADHD too. It's nothing you can't overcome. It's just that you haven't learned the skill set to deal with discomfort and uncomfortable in a better way that leads you towards traction. So we try and constantly escape it with distraction.
See, it's interesting that you say that. It's almost like this set of avoidance that we have when it comes to pain sometimes. And the other part you say is you've talked about distraction too. I'm curious too, Nia, because as of 2024, kids in America are being diagnosed with ADHD 10 times higher than kids in Europe. Why is it so bad here in America?
Well, because I think in America, everybody gets an ADHD diagnosis. I've never met someone who's gone to a psychiatrist and said, hey, I think I have ADHD, who doesn't get a diagnosis, including myself. I did this for myself just to see, like, oh, I wonder if I can have a diagnosis. Yeah, sure, you get a diagnosis. I mean, you can get a diagnosis through an app these days. It's in your interest as a parent, frankly, to get your kid a diagnosis. They get more time on tests. They get special treatment. Their school gets more funding. And so the entire system is set up to diagnose kids. And that's not the case in Europe. It soon will be because the psychiatry industry has no check and balance. Let's be honest. There's nobody who says, hey, are we abusing this system? Is this correct? Not that ADHD isn't a thing, by the way. I want to be very, very clear. ADHD is probably, as far as we know, a thing. But I think it's way, way, way overdiagnosed. And now that wouldn't necessarily be a problem. Okay, a lot of kids get extra time on tests and special attention. That's not the worst thing in the world. I think when it starts to get really dangerous is then when we start popping pills inside of our kids. And these pills, unfortunately, have side effects. They have physiological side effects, right? We're giving kids amphetamines. These drugs are amphetamines. So they have negative side effects, but also psychological side effects. We don't know what happens to children who start on these medications when they become adults. From a psychological perspective, you're building this dependency, a psychological dependency on, oh, in order to concentrate, in order to think, in order to be not bad, I have to pop pills. That also comes with a psychological consequence. And so it's not that I'm saying kids don't have ADHD and they shouldn't, and some kids shouldn't get medication. I'm not saying that. I think there are circumstances where that is the appropriate course of treatment. However, pills don't teach skills. I'll say it again. Pills don't teach skills. So we are so quick to pop a pill to solve our problems without thinking about the consequences. So first and foremost, before you or your children or anyone you know starts taking pills to solve a problem, we should probably think about non-pharmaceutical interventions. And that's what this book is for, right? These are simple tactics anyone can try to become indistractable. Now, if it doesn't work and you've tried everything, okay, no other option. I get it. But first and foremost, try everything in my book, which is used by thousands of ADHD coaches and practitioners, let alone, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who have ADHD who use this book to find ways to solve these same problems without pills. Because remember, we don't have a blood test for ADHD. We don't have an x-ray for ADHD. It's a self-reported diagnosis, right? You fill out a survey, they ask you a bunch of questions. Do you feel this? Do you feel this? How bad is it? And then you take a little test to see how much you can focus, which is very easy to, you know, lose focus around. And so if I can cure those symptoms, if on that self-reported survey, you go from I always experience distraction to I almost never experience distraction, guess what? You are functionally cured. You no longer have the diagnosis.
Could you share some of the practices that's made a big difference from what you've mentioned in your book and everything?
Sure. Yeah. So let's talk about these four basic steps. Now, I wanted to do what I think no other book on this topic has really done, which is explain the deeper psychology of distraction. Why do we get distracted in the first place? So we can do something about the problem. So that's really, I think, the differentiating factor behind the book is to really learn the deeper psychology. So once we know the strategy, we can come up with our own tactics that serve us. The strategy is, number one, first and foremost, is master internal triggers. That's the most important thing. We talked about those uncomfortable internal triggers. We have to learn tactics to master them. The next step is to make time for traction. Because if you don't plan your day, somebody or something is going to plan it for you. Because you can't say you got distracted unless you know what you got distracted from. So I teach people how to differentiate between what is traction, what is what I wanted to do, and what is distraction. And if you don't plan traction, if you don't know what you're supposed to be doing in that time, what are you complaining for? Or you can't say you got distracted unless you know what you got distracted from. So that's step number two, make time for traction. Number three, hack back the external triggers. So this is where we do work on the 10% of those external triggers, the pings, the dings, the rings. That's where we work on those 10%. Even though they're only 10%, there's some easy things we can do very quickly to account for those external triggers. And, you know, there's simple stuff like making your phone indistractable. I can show you how to do that in about 30 minutes. Your computer, making that indistractable. That's easy stuff. That's child's play. I devote very little time in the book for that. The harder stuff and the more important stuff and the bigger time sinks are the things like meetings. How many stupid meetings do we go to that didn't need to be called, that are nothing more than a distraction? How many emails? Oh my God, how many emails do we get that should not have been sent to us and we should not have replied to, right? So how do we systematically go through all those external triggers and hack back those external triggers? And then the fourth and final step is to prevent distraction with pacts. And so this is where we use what's called a pre-commitment device so that we have like a firewall against distraction, the last line of defense, so that if anything else goes wrong, we know that there's this barrier between us and distraction. So that's preventing distraction with pacts. And if you use these four strategies in concert, master internal triggers, make time for traction, hack back external triggers, prevent distraction with pacts, if you use those four strategies in concert, anybody can become indistractable.
So mastering internal triggers, that's one of the first things that you said. So that's obviously something that requires us to go inward to see, okay, what's actually causing us to do this. Could you give us an example of what that could be?
Sure, yeah. So based on what that internal trigger is, we need to have a plan in place. We need to have a toolkit, knowing that, hey, when I feel a certain way, bored, lonely, indecisive, stressed, anxious, when I feel this way, what am I going to do? Am I going to try and escape that discomfort? Am I going to drink it away? Am I going to click it away? Am I going to scroll it away? What am I going to do when I feel that discomfort? And so distracted people keep getting distracted by the same thing again and again and again. Indistractable people say, okay, I see what you did there. Okay, I understand why I got distracted, and I'm going to do something about it tomorrow. So Paulo Coelho, he had a wonderful quote. He said, a mistake repeated more than once is a decision. Such a good quote. A mistake repeated more than once is a decision. So, okay, you got distracted once. Why? Was it an internal trigger, an external trigger, or a planning problem? It's the only three reasons for any distraction. So the idea is that you say, okay, I see why I got distracted. I'm going to prevent that from happening again. So the first thing you can do when it comes to internal triggers is to understand what was that internal trigger. You're not going to blame yourself. You're not going to shame yourself. You're not broken. You're not wrong. Just what was I feeling? Was I feeling bored? Was I feeling lonely? Was I feeling anxious? Great. What was that sensation? Now, what will I do with that sensation next time I experience it? Okay, so as opposed to, this project is really hard. I don't like it. It's difficult work. Let me go check my email, right? I hear this all the time. Well, email is, that's a work-related task. I got to check email today. So we justify it in our brains thinking, oh, that's something I have to do anyway for my job. But if it's not what you said you were going to do at that moment in time, it's a distraction just as much as playing video games or going on social media. So understand that, okay, when I feel anxious, when a task is hard, I have this desire to try and escape. What am I going to do instead? What am I going to do with that sensation? And so there's all kinds of techniques you can use. I give over a dozen different methodologies. One of my favorites is called the 10-minute rule. I use this almost every single day because I'm a professional author. Writing is really, really hard. It never becomes easier. And so every day while I'm writing, all I want to do is check the news and stock prices and sports scores and do anything but the writing. And so many times what I'll do is I say, okay, I'm feeling stressed right now. I'm feeling anxious. I'm feeling whatever it is that I might be feeling that moment. Okay, what's going on? Where's this coming from? And then I have to reimagine that trigger. So before I used to beat myself up thinking, oh, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad. Instead, I say, wait, you know, it's because I really care about this, right? I really want my writing to affect people and improve their lives and improve my life from what I'm learning. So of course I'm going to be anxious because I want this to be great. So I'm reimagining the internal trigger. And then I have practices in place to deal with that discomfort. So the 10-minute rule says that you can give in to that distraction. Okay, I can go check the news or stock prices or whatever in 10 minutes. Not right now, in 10 minutes. And so your job for that 10 minutes is to just stop for a second, take a deep breath, and now you have a choice to make. You can either get back to the task at hand, or you can do what's called surf the urge. Surfing the urge acknowledges that these sensations, these internal triggers, are like waves. They crest and they subside. And so if you can just surf that urge for just a few minutes, you'll find that it'll pass, just like any sensation. But that's not what we think about in the minute, right? Like when we feel bored, oh, this is always going to be boring. When I feel stressed, oh, I'm always going to feel stressed. Of course, that's not true. So if you can just ride out that sensation like a surfer on a surfboard for just a few minutes, you'll find the sensation will pass quicker than you expect. And so what I do in that 10 minutes is I'll just close my eyes. And another technique I espouse is about having a personal mantra. So I reimagine that internal trigger of this is hard, this sucks, I'm bored, I'm anxious, this is terrible, into a simple mantra. And the mantra is, you can steal it, you can make up your own. My mantra is, this is what it feels like to get better. This is what it feels like to get better. So I've reimagined that stress, that anxiety, that bad feeling as, wait a minute, this is serving me. This isn't hurting me, right? This is a good thing. This is what it feels like to get better. So that's just the tip of the iceberg. But those are just a few practical tips that I use every day to master those internal triggers. Because one of the things that people do is they say, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And of course, the more we tell ourselves not to do something, the more we want to do it because we keep thinking about it. Whereas we say to ourselves, hey, you can do that thing. You can smoke the cigarette. You can eat the chocolate cake. You can check social media. You can do any of those things. You're a grown person. But you choose to not do it for 10 minutes. And so what you're doing over time, every time you do that, you say, okay, I can check it, but in 10 minutes, what you're doing is you're building that self-efficacy. You're showing yourself, hey, you know what? I've got control over these emotions. They don't control me. And of course, then the 10-minute rule becomes the 12-minute rule, becomes the 15-minute rule, becomes the 20-minute rule. And wait, where's my ADHD again? Right? Where's my distractibility again? No, you've overcome it because you're showing yourself, you're proving yourself, okay, I can do this. And if 10 minutes is too long, by the way, start with 5 minutes. But you're just proving to yourself, yep, I can do this by recognizing the internal trigger, taking that minute, having a practice, having a toolkit in place that I know what to do with that discomfort that I've decided in advance, right? Don't leave it to the last minute. I know that when I feel that emotion, here's what I'm going to do instead of the distraction. And then just practicing that every single time and extending how long you're resisting that temptation. And so what you'll find is over time, it's a skill like any other.
Well, that sense of practice too, every day kind of getting more confidence in yourself and learning to trust yourself more, that really does help to build up that traction, which is the next step we're going to make, time for traction. I remember when I took your Indestructible course on Mindvalley, I was in Romania. I was there for a couple of weeks. And one thing you said really hit me, saying that time block the things that you're going to do because you need to train yourself to believe that you're going to do these things. And that's how you're going to build that muscle to consistency. And I'm paraphrasing what you said there, but that really stayed with me because everything on my schedule, I'm like, all right, I'm going to show up to the gym. That's my intention. And then as you practice that, as you keep flexing that muscle, you believe, oh, I am someone who is healthy and looks after my body, so I'm going to honor my time blocking. So I've kind of jumped ahead to the answer, but make time for traction, Nia. Could you kind of talk a little bit more about that too?
That's a great summary. Essentially, what we're doing is destroying the to-do list. To-do lists are one of the worst things you can do for your personal productivity. There is very little research on to-do lists that shows that it's effective, but as opposed to time blocking, which is just setting aside time for what you're going to do and when you're going to do it, is incredibly effective. Tens of thousands of studies have found that this is an incredibly effective technique. All you're doing is saying, here's what I'm going to do in that specific period of time. Because remember, you can't say you got distracted unless you know what you got distracted from. So just having on your to-do list, exercise, write, finish a project, that's stupid, right? That doesn't work. We know to-do lists don't work because what you're doing is measuring yourself by how many cute little boxes you check off. And so what do? You do the easy stuff. You do the fun stuff. You do the urgent stuff. You don't do the stuff that has to get done, the hard work you know you need to do to move your life and career forward. That's what you procrastinate on. So rather, what you need to do is to have a time on your calendar. This is when I'm going to do what I say I'm going to do. Now, the metric, this is a lot of people get confused about time blocking. They think it's about finishing the task. That's incorrect. Okay. And they get stressed out like, well, what if I budget an hour? I don't finish in an hour. The goal is not to finish. The goal is not to finish. The goal is to see how much you can do in that period of time when you work without distraction. Completely different metric of success. Why do you do that? Because let's say I'm going to work on a slide presentation. Okay, I got a big presentation coming up and I need to deliver 30 slides. Okay, well, if I do a time block for 1 hour and I finish 3 slides, well, now I know it's going to take me 9 more of those time blocks to finish the entire task. But the only way I can do that is by apportioning out how much time I'm going to work on that task and then seeing the output, right? You can't have output without input. Well, the input is our time and attention. So you have to budget that in advance. What I take people through is this exercise of looking at your life domains, you, your relationships, and then finally your work. And I show you how to plan your day, how to plan your calendar so that you are living according to your values. What are values? Values are attributes of the person you want to become. So you're going to ask yourself, how would the person I want to become spend their time taking care of themselves, taking care of their family, their relationships, and taking care of their work by looking at the time you have available? Now, what that will invariably do is show you, you don't have enough time. You're going to have more things you want to accomplish than hours in the day. But the idea is that you know that as opposed to wishing you had more time and then saying, oh, I didn't get everything done. The reason to-do lists are so stupid that there's no constraint. You can always add more and more and more and more and more to a to-do list. So you feel like incompetent at the end of your day when you didn't finish everything, right? As opposed to a time box calendar, you say, look, this is when I'm going to spend time with my kids. This is when I'm going to read a book. This is when I'm going to be on social media. This is when I'm going to work without distraction. This is when I'm going to check email. You know exactly what you're going to do and when you're going to do it and for how much time so that you can live according to your priorities. Now, that might mean you have to make some trade-offs. Of course you do, right? But your trade-offs are made in advance as opposed to after the fact. Oh, honey, I need to keep working on this big project. It's taking longer than expected. Sorry, I can't be home with the kids. I can't make it to the gym. I can't do this. I can't do that. Well, with this, you know exactly in advance how you want to spend your time, how to live according to your values, and how to live without regret.
So in essence, the myth around time blocking is you must do things to completion, but that's actually not the case at all. It is to do things in the allocated time that you block it out for.
That's right. By figuring out how long things take, that is how you finish them to completion, right? It's not about finishing within the time block. It's about just working on that thing during that time block so you can see actually how long it takes.
We talked about like certain things that we need to move around and prioritize, which brings us to the third step, hacking back external triggers. Can you talk us through how to kind of hack back on these triggers and how to manage them?
Yeah, so external triggers come in all kinds of forms. It can be from our phone, it can be from our kids, it can be from our boss, it can be email, all kinds of external triggers, anything in our outside environment that tells us what to do, and that can lead towards traction or distraction. And it's not that necessarily external triggers are bad. I woke up this morning from an external trigger, an alarm that told me, hey, it was time to wake up and do this interview. And so they're not bad. It's just that we have to ask ourselves this fundamental question of, is this trigger serving me or am I serving it? Okay, so for every one of these external triggers, asking yourself, okay, is that constant notification from some stupid news app, is that actually serving you? Does this really improve your life? Is this really according to your values? Or is that trigger using you to make that advertiser more money, right? To make that app or technology company more money. And so that's really what these external triggers are about. And it turns out that we can systematically hack back each and every one of these external triggers. We can reduce our email time by 50%. We can improve meetings. That's a huge time suck in corporate America, is stupid meetings that people don't need to go to. We can systematically go through each and every one of those external triggers. And I show people how to do that in that book chapter.
So let's talk about PACs and the kind of PACs there are.
So essentially, there's three kinds of PACs. We have price PACs, identity PACs, and effort PACs. And so a PACt is a line of defense. It's a firewall. So when you have an effort PACt, you're putting some bit of work between you and the distraction. A price PACt has some kind of financial cost, financial disincentive to doing something. And the most powerful of the three PACs is what's called an identity PACt. When you call yourself something, you become more likely to behave in accordance with that identity. So when someone says they're a vegetarian, they don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, I'd really like a bacon sandwich for breakfast. No, I am a vegetarian. It's who I am. And so that's what they eat, right? So that's why the book is titled Indistractable. It's your identity. It's meant to sound like indestructible. And so when you are indistractable, it is who you are, is part of your identity. So that means that, you know what, if you can tell people, hey, I'm sorry, you know, I don't respond to every text message within 30 seconds because sometimes I have work blocks because you see, I am indistractable. Is that so different from someone saying, hey, you know what, I'm Muslim and when I'm praying, I don't call you back because I'm doing my prayer, right? Like people would understand that. Is it so different if you say, hey, we're having lunch with a friend and you say, hey, you know, I see you're checking your phone. Is everything okay? Because you see, I'm indistractable. So if it's okay, you know, if we're going to be together, let's be together both in body and mind, right? Is that so weird from someone saying, hey, I'm vegetarian. And so I'm going to order this, you know, can we go to the vegetarian restaurant or a restaurant that has a vegetarian option? No, people accommodate this stuff. And so what I'm hoping to do is to convert an army. We need to start this new religion of people who say, I am indistractable, right? I don't allow my time to be manipulated by others. I control my time and attention. And the more people who do this, who stand up and say, look, this is the way I run my life, the more unacceptable it becomes to do rude things like phone fubbing, like what I did to my daughter. That becomes less and less acceptable once this becomes a norm.
Because when you are in that distracted mode, you have regret for the time that you didn't do the things you actually really wanted to do.
That's right. I mean, that's what this is all about. Big, big picture, it's about living a life by minimizing regret. And I think very few people, almost nobody listening to me right now on this podcast has ever experienced a day in your life where you do what you say you're going to do for the entire day. It is the coolest feeling, right? To get up when you say you will, to go to the gym when you say you will, to be with your family when you say you will, to do your work when you say you will. It is the coolest thing. It feels amazing because it's kind of stress-free. You're not constantly thinking, oh, when? When will I finish? When will I do this? When will I do that? You know exactly where you're going to do that. It's in your calendar. So you just do it. And it feels amazing because you don't feel like you're neglecting anyone. You say to yourself, hey, here's how much time I have for myself. Here's how much time I have for my family and my relationships. Here's how much time I have for work. That's decided in advance, as opposed to what most of us feel is, oh, my kids want more time and my work wants more time and I need more time. We're constantly being pulled and stretched in different directions. When you become indistractable, it's decided in advance according to your values. And that's the only way we can look back on our days, our weeks, our months, our years, our life without regret.
You talked about, made those decisions about how much time you want to spend with your work, your partner, your friends, your life, that sort of stuff. in our audience of The Genie Show, we have a lot of creatives. And I know creatives especially go to scheduling because they feel it's this restrictive thing that crushes their creativity, that stifles their flair. But actually having that structure allows that freedom, that creativity to flow a little bit more. And you've talked about this as well as, focus, flow, and the creative mind. How do you structure your day to protect creative time?
Well, I think there's a difference between people who like to be creative as a hobby. Okay. Like if you're retired, be creative whenever you want. You got nothing but time. But I would refer people to Stephen Pressfield's book, The War of Art. And the whole book is about creativity, but it's about, it's a war of art. It's talking about how if you want to be a professional, you don't wait for the muse. You don't wait till you feel inspiration. That's not what professionals do. You know what professionals do? Whether they feel like it or not, whether they feel creative or not, they get their butt in the chair and they do the work. They show up. That's what professionals do. Everybody else, you're a hobbyist. Professionals do the work. And so people who, if you want to have a hobby, when you have free time, spare time, sure. But if you depend on your creativity to make a living, whether that's in the business domain, business requires a lot of creativity, whether it's writing, whether it's whatever you're doing for a living, and you necessitate creativity, it's incredible how suddenly you become creative when you plan the time to do so. But what most people do is they'll do everything but, okay, I got to check social media, I got to check the news, I got to check email, I got to figure out the kids, I got this drama, this thing. And then I'll create when I feel like it. BS. You don't. You create when you say you will. You put your butt in the chair and lo and behold, the muse arrives.
One hack that you gave me, which I use with my lovely wife sometimes, is especially when you're working from home, especially in this day and age, right? People are coming in and out, put those headphones on, nobody interrupts me. It's great. So how do you kind of keep yourself creatively energized, but also how do you protect your time to be able to create the books that you do?
Well, I plan that time in advance. And I tell my family. So when my daughter was much younger, I would put on those headphones and she would say, daddy, daddy, daddy. And frankly, she didn't realize what I was working on because sometimes I would wear the headphones when I was listening to a podcast. And then sometimes I'd wear the headphones when I was doing really important focused work. And so we actually came up with a system that where we have what's called the concentration crown. We don't use it anymore because my daughter's 16, but when she was younger, we had this light up LED crown that we got from Amazon for $5 or something. And whenever I wore it or my wife would wear this concentration crown, it would tell my daughter that we can't be interrupted because it was a very clear signal that whenever mommy or daddy was wearing the concentration crown, we can't be interrupted. It would be no more than 30 minutes. The time block was 30 minutes. So go draw, go play with some toy, go do something else. Because unless you're bleeding, that was the rule in my household. Unless you are bleeding, you can't interrupt us. And it worked like a charm because frankly, she didn't know when we couldn't be interrupted. So it was very, very effective. So in the office, actually something that I have in every single copy of my book is what's called a screen sign. So it's this piece of cardstock that you tear out, you fold it into thirds, and you actually put it on your computer monitor because it explicitly tells your colleagues, I can't be distracted right now. Because again, when you just wear headphones, it works for some people, but in many office settings, people don't know what that means, right? They think you're watching a YouTube video or something. And so to be explicit to say, no, this is my time when I'm working without distraction can be very, very effective.